So Tom, your plan here busts one of your personal minimums to not try this approach again. And I can understand, you know, you've justified it well. It makes sense why you would do it. But isn't the point of having personal minimums that you then don't have to make these decisions in the heat of the battle? It's an objective, you know, binary yes or no thing. And you can think about it after the flight, like you say. But in the moment, isn't there value in just on principle sticking to your personal minimum?
Yeah, great question. And one that I sort of struggled with when thinking this through. And would that we lived in a black and white world where decision making was always that simple. But again, as I said, when we talk about, you know, not flying an approach again, what are the parameters around even that? Because like I said, if you very early in the approach get off course by a little bit because of distraction or something like that, but you've now technically should be doing a missed approach because, you know, the needle pegged where you got distracted for a couple of minutes, but you're easily salvaged this approach and you know that's good conditions below. Are you going to go around and go to your alternate? And, you know, where does this end? So I think this is a situation where I feel comfortable making this decision that this is a situation where I don't feel like I'm really violating that because of the fact that I did see the airport. And if I'd had the lights on, it clearly would have been in the right place at the right time and everything would have been fine. But it's a great question. I mean, I think we do need to, as I said, consider and reconsider on a regular basis what are our personal minimums and that sort of thing. And I wish we did live in a black and white world where it was really easy to make those decisions. But this was one where I felt like it was justified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's more the spirit of that personal minimum is that you don't want to tempt yourself to duck under. And that temptation, you're saying, doesn't really exist here. So like that's not the point of this rule. You're just going to fly the approach the same way, and it's going to work this time
right.
Because you're going to turn on the lights.
Yes.
Right?
In theory, yes.
In theory, right.
And the weather's going to stay the same or get better.
Right. Well, we have a meteorologist here. So, JP, does the weather always stay the same or get better? Are you concerned at all about the visibility dropping, for example, on this approach, the second take?
In this particular case, I'm not concerned about the situation changing. It's weather's very dynamic, but this particular case seems like what we call stratiform rain. We have some low visibility. And what this really comes down to is I looking at this and just trying to think about it from my personal standpoint, early in my flying, I would have just gone, number four, I'm going to go to the area of least risk. I'm going to get to Fort Smith. There's not going to be an issue. We're not going to be pushing those minimums as we try to get into McAllister. But what Tom says, that approach really didn't work, most likely because a critical element was not happening there, and that was keying those lights. Needed the lights, didn't see them. So you get into this area where, yeah, I'm busting my personal minimum, because I'm doing the approach again and potentially busting another personal minimum with the fuel if I'm going to try to get to Fort Smith. But with the weather situation the way it is, I would do that approach again, considering that I'm proficient and I'm comfortable with that. If I'm someone who's not very instrument current, maybe I'm not as capable with the avionics in that particular airplane, I'm not going to do the approach again. That's my caveat to this, that I'm going to head to Fort Smith. But if I feel comfortable, and the only reason I think that I missed this and messed it up is because of those approach lights, I'm going to go ahead and do that again. I don't think the weather in this particular case, you don't have thunderstorms all over the place closing in on you, any rapidly changing conditions. So I think number one is probably the best course of action.
Bruce, you're going to divert right away to Fort Smith, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm not really confident that the weather is surely going to be the same or better when I come back around again. And I'm also concerned about another thing, which is, okay, I have to go missed again for whatever reason. I'm now going to one of my alternates, but now I'm already into my personal minimums on reserve fuel. And what if there's an ATC delay? Or, you know, I don't know what's going to happen at Fort Smith. Is there somebody else going in there that I'm going to get delayed, have to hold? Now I'm eating even further into it. So I'm just a bit concerned about what happens down the road if I don't make it in there.
Mm-hmm. Now, one way to preserve that personal minimum for fuel would be to go to Stigler instead after missing at McAllister. Is anybody going to do that? Is that your plan B now? Because Fort Smith was the original filed alternate, but mostly just because it was the one that you could file, right? It's got an ILS approach versus the RNAV at Stigler. Tom, say you don't get in the second time.
Right.
Where are you going?
Yeah, I'd probably look at Stigler at that point, just for those reasons. You preserve some of those fuel minimums, and you know it's a reasonable approach. So yeah, that's probably what I would do.
Doug.
Yeah, in speaking with a controller, when you go missed and ATC says, say intentions, and you say you want to go to your filed alternate, do they know where that is? And they don't. It's not on their strip. And I made a statement saying that they'd have to go to flight service to get it. Controller came back and said, the only reason you have to file an alternate is to meet FAA regulations. Okay, but the fact of the matter is we do not have to go what we filed. And so certainly Stigler, you know, I'm going to go for the approach again. The only thing that I would do would be requesting vectors rather than going to a HAMU and having to do this procedure turn just to save time. But then if I have to go missed on that second one, then I am going. The other thing I want to talk about here is something that a term that I heard on one of the work groups. We're now under the GAJSC system component failure non-power plant about pilots tearing airplanes apart quite often in turbulence and things of that nature. And it was a term called safety drift that I had never heard before. Apparently it is out there in the 121 world. But basically addressing complacency, and certainly several of the accidents that we've already looked at in that work group, we see pilots having safety drift. And here is an exact example of safety drift. We've got our personal minimums in a variety of different ways, and yet we're going to allow ourselves to break them. You know, and I'll admit, I'm guilty of this myself. You know, we really have to watch for this safety drift, that we have these things that we've determined and we try to live by them, and yet real world comes up, a situation like this, and we say, yeah, no, we'll go back and do it a second time.
But you are going to do it a second time.
Yes.
Then,
so, yeah. Drifting away.
Dave.
Yeah, the pilot gets a mulligan on this one because the second approach is different. I mean, it's the same physical approach, but with the lights on, the character is different. The chances of getting in successfully go way up. Also, you know, we talk so much about personal minimums, and usually rightly so, but let's not get so boxed in by, you know, there's plenty of rules in aviation already. Do we really need to box ourselves in with even more? You know, I mean, it sounds like heresy to question personal minimums, but it's like this pilot is, if he's inflexible and cuts out his best options with these blind adherence to these personal minimums, that's not helping the safety cause. You know, it seems the safest thing he can do is do the approach again. He's just had some practice on it. It'll be better this time. And considering the diversion, the place to save fuel is on this initial leg, the long flight to McAllister. That gives him plenty of opportunities to go lean a peak, fly to different altitude, all this normal strategies that we can do to be more efficient. And maybe that will get him more fuel for the diversion if he absolutely has to divert.
Yeah.
And diverting to, what is it, Fort Smith. Fort Smith. Fort Smith has a really good Waffle House. So that's where I'm going on the diversion.
Nice. Mark.
I went with the do-over mostly because been there, done that. I was doing an approach, and I forgot to turn on the approach lights. And they break out of the clouds, and I go, there should be a runway somewhere in front of me, and it wasn't anywhere there. And it was later on I said, oh, my God, what a dummy, and wound up making a little note on my approach plates now where I circle the PCL as a reminder of it. But I think the other big point is the regulatory and practical status of the alternates that we file. It really is just a flight planning function of what is the worst-case scenario and where is the place that we are almost guaranteed to get in. It doesn't matter, and we can go anywhere that we want to. And ATC doesn't know what it is, and we just go to the best place. In fact, I plan that way. I choose an alternate, usually based upon it having an ILS, so it's a guaranteed get in. But then I consider what my other alternates are, the real places that I might go in case of a missed approach.
So you may have planned this flight with Fort Smith as an alternate, but in your mind, would Stigler be the real alternate?
Well, based upon the weather, maybe that, maybe someplace else, but I wouldn't limit myself to thinking in terms of the filed alternate being my only choice.
Right. You got to consider Waffle Houses.
Right.
it's quite possible that there might be an airport 5 miles away that's severe clear, but is labeled NA for filing as an alternate. That doesn't mean we can't go there.
Exactly.
Right. Bruce.
But getting back to that sort of creeping, you know, safety slippage, forgot what term.
Safety drift.
Safety drift. There we go. I'm a little bit concerned that, okay, I think I screwed up this approach because I didn't turn on the lights. I come back around. I remember to turn on the lights. But now the weather has gotten just a little bit worse. Am I going to feel more pressure now to continue this approach farther than I really should? Just a little back of my mind thing. Yeah, you know, 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, I was pretty sure I could get in if I just had the lights. But weather changes, and you come back around, and now it's slightly worse, and you turn on the lights, but now you don't see things the way you thought you were going to see things. Do you continue? And now you've burned some extra fuel. So
it's also possible that you did key up the lights, right?
Right.
And they don't work. Dave.
Yeah, I've heard that safety drift, of normalization of deviance, which is a, you know, quite, could mean a lot of different things, I guess. But it's like the lights make such a difference. I remember one time making an instrument approach to an extremely rainy airport. And it was so rainy, in fact, that I could not transmit, that it was creating static on the aircraft and messing up the radios to the point that I couldn't transmit to turn the lights on. And I was just sort of descending to minimums and looking and looking and seeing nothing in this big black hole. And finally, you know, the rain relented. I was able to get the lights on, and it was suddenly brilliantly illuminated. And, you know, I got to think that in this situation, it would be similar.
Tom.
Yeah, so similar story. I was in a Conquest, Cessna Conquest once, and we were flying an approach to a home airport, and so one we knew well, and the pilot forgot to activate the approach lights, and we ended up missing the approach. But just as we, you know, started the missed approach, there's the ground. We could see the runway and that sort of thing, but we're already in the climb, and pilot did the right thing, continued, and we actually went to the alternate, which was super unhelpful, very inconvenient, and that sort of thing. And that was probably another situation where if we did come back around and tried it again with the lights, we'd have probably pretty easily gotten in.
Bruce.
Another thing I thought of, though, here was, now it's not specific to this situation because you do have lights, but with RNAV approaches now, even with LPV minimums, there's a lot of runways out there that you have LPV minimums to with no lights. You might have a PAPI or a VASI and some dim runway edge lights. And this just raises the point that during your pre-flight planning, you really need to look at the charts and have some idea of what you're going to expect, because you're flying what feels like an ILS on an approach with LPV minimums, and you're expecting maybe all the visual aids you might have, and often you won't have them anymore. I also agree strongly with Mark's comment about putting a mark on your chart. I put PCL next to the final approach fix on such charts just to remind myself, okay, part of my check is altitude, and, oh, yeah, I got to click the mic. Not that I've ever forgotten to turn on the pilot control lighting, but...
JP.
Yeah, I think especially those of us that fly mainly into towered fields, it's very easy to forget that one aspect that is just a given. You're going into a Class Charlie or even a Delta, and you know the lights are there. And in this case, it's a deal breaker because you didn't see what you were expecting to see. But back to the whole personal minimums thing, something that I struggle with, you know, in a piston airplane, I have personal minimums versus when I'm flying the jet. Those are completely different animals. I think the personal minimums, as a rule, this is the one case where this is a substantially different situation where, according to Tom, he has not keyed on the lights, and he keys on the lights, he's going to be able to make that because he was starting to make out features even that first go around. The personal minimums we need to stay with, if you set those, they need to not so much box you in, but that needs to be pretty much the rules that you live by, 95% of the time. If you go to the 121 world and you look at their accident rates, they have some op specs that they live by, and it keeps them out of trouble. So when you have something that's well-defined there and you can just say, this is the way it's going to be, it's going to keep you out of things that perhaps you shouldn't be, or stretching a fuel issue or something like that. Nothing worse than trying to get into an airport. Now you're fuel critical, and man, I can't go missed on this. I have got to land. That's a bad place to be.
Yeah. Doug?
What JP just said, and I do have to agree with him, what I wanted to address when he mentioned going into a towered airport, don't always count that the tower's going to turn the lights on for you. And I remember once going into Boston Logan at night, and they had told me plan four left, and I'm flying, and I'm just not seeing any light. And four rights over here, I can see that. And there's airliners coming in beside me. I said, tower, could you turn on the lights for four left, please? They had forgotten to turn them on. When they turned them on, they brought them up at full brightness. And now I was blinded and had to go around.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it's not a guarantee that the tower's necessarily going to turn on the lights or bring them up bright. But so often in all the flying I've done, when I've had to go missed, quite often it's because of a visibility issue and that the lights either weren't there or I might have neglected to turn them on. So pilots, a lot of early low-time IFR pilots think, well, lights are only at night. No. You know, it might be noon and you might have been on top in severe clear with your sunglasses on. But turn those lights on as you fly the approach.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, there's a little bit of a potential gotcha here if you go to Stigler instead. Stigler doesn't have approach lights. It has an LPV that gets you to 250, which is well below what the ceilings are now. But, you know, if the weather becomes what it is at McAllister, you might be right in the same spot again. Bruce?
Just one other comment. If I did want to go back around or choose option one, I might be more tempted to do that if I had a tool like Synthetic Vision on a G1000 or one of the newer, you know, PFD-type displays, which could really give me more confidence that I know I'm going to, you know, fly a better approach, but I also will have a better idea of where I'm going to look for the runway when I break out. That would give me a little more confidence. We don't really know exactly what, you know, avionics you've got, what kind of PFD, for example, you have, but that might be a...
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's also, it depends a lot on what type of synthetic vision you have, right? So like in your plane where it's all integrated, that's perfect. But if you're looking at an iPad,
yeah,
here,
that's not what I'm talking about.
No, I know you're not. Yeah. But that's going to contribute to the same thing that happened, because one thing that probably happened here is there's a strong crosswind and the pilot just wasn't looking in the right place for the runway.
Right.
And the iPad, which doesn't know heading in most setups, is just going to make that worse.
And Tom made a great point in his response that one of the items you should brief on an approach is we've got a strong crosswind from the left. If I just look over the nose, that's not where the runway is going to be. I need to know where I should be looking.
Another thing, too, is just the fact of an HSI. And there's still pilots out there with the DG. I remember the first time I flew an HSI, I'd had my instrument rating for a while, I was, wow, does this make this easier? I remember the first approach I did to minimums was going into Lawrence. This is by myself, with a strong crosswind, coming down to minimums. I got down to 200 feet and a half a mile with a DG, and I looked out in front, and I'm staring at those big towers that are there at Lawrence. Where's the runway? Oh, it's over here to the right. That HSI makes it so much easier, and to me is a big... Even if you don't have all the fancy glass, if you're flying instruments, at least get yourself an HSI.
I want to talk about this forgetting to key up the approach lights, because show of hands, who's done that? No? Okay, all right.
I make enough other mistakes in aviation that I have not done that one.
Yeah, so we got like four of the six say yes, and the other two I'm not so sure about. But I certainly have, and I've had students who've done it regularly, so apparently I don't teach the right procedure for remembering it. But, Doug, I mean, I'm sure you've seen it 1,000 times with the people you fly with. What do you teach for when to keep the lights and how to remember to do it?
For me, final fix. Because the problem, some people will key them on, but many of the non-towered airports, it's 15 minutes.
Times out.
And it times out just as you're on short final. And that really can ruin your day. So for me, final fix.
That makes sense.
Early and often.
Yeah, you can't do it enough times.
Yeah, it's a fun thing as the instructor to have your student forget to key up the lights at night on an approach. You know, they're under the hood and you're watching yourselves descend into a black hole. And you're like, yeah, this is all right. I trust this. I like the idea, JP, you had about about Part 121 op specs, right, and comparing personal minimums to that, because those are a set of really specific rules that you can't bust. You're not allowed to. And that's part of the reason I think that airlines have such perfect safety records, right? And I think we'd all probably agree that if you set a personal minimum and you're specific enough about it, you shouldn't bust it in the moment. But at the same time, we can sit back and look at the scenario and say, yeah, it makes some sense to try this approach again. And part of that is the lack of specificness of this personal rule, I think. So if you're going to have personal minimums, make them specific, concrete, easy to assess. And then also, you know, practicing making decisions like this when you're not in the heat of the battle, that'll help make these things feel familiar when they come up in real life, and you'll be able to assess them better.